I'd like you to think about the battle space of the future. There is no question that combat aircraft will play a big role in that fight. Bombers, fighters, electronic attack platforms, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance planes, you get the picture. However, unlike when I flew the F-16 as part of a team where we all strapped into the jets and launched, tomorrow is going to stack up differently. A good portion of combat aircraft, and I'm talking well past what we have today, will be unmanned. We are going to see them work as partners with traditional planes that are still manned by crews. This is a concept we call manned-unmanned teaming, and it is going to be one of the biggest developments that reshapes how we think about air warfare. That is what today's show is all about. To learn more about this vision, understand why we are going this way, the possibilities that it affords, and talk to the experts making it possible. Welcome to Episode 9 of the Mitchell Institute's Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, Lieutenant Colonel Retired John Slickbaum. Now, for many of you listening, you're thinking, what are you talking about? We've had unmanned aircraft in combat for years. Well, you're right. In fact, we have had various forms of unmanned aircraft going all the way back to World War I. Just about everyone has heard about Predator and Reaper, the unmanned sensor shooter aircraft made famous over Iraq and Afghanistan for the past almost 20 years. There's also Global Hawk, the ISR aircraft made famous when it flew from the United States to Australia without anyone at the controls. But here's the deal. These aircraft represent an earlier generation of technology. In the case of Predator and Reaper, they are remotely piloted, which means they're flown by crews who are likely located on the other side of the globe, controlling the planes through real-time data links. Those folks control the flight inputs, operate the sensors, and employ the weapons. For an aircraft like Global Hawk, it's generally flying off a pre-programmed script of mission commands. Folks can retask it in flight, and it'll respond to the inputs real-time. And to be clear, both methodologies are incredible accomplishments, and trust me, I was there working with these assets and the airmen behind the controls. It is mind-blowing to see what these crews and their aircraft could accomplish. This was a game-changing moment in combat aviation, and here's why the unmanned technology was so important. It allowed for exceedingly long endurance missions that far exceeded what a human in a cockpit could endure. There's a huge advantage when trying to collect data or observe an enemy's pattern of life or maybe immediately detecting a key change in the battle space. It also speaks to the notion of why we pursue unmanned technologies. It's not to have a new toy to show off. It's about gaining mission results that humans would have a hard time delivering given basic physiological or mental processing factors. There are points where the machines have advantages. And to be fair, so do humans in certain areas. What we are after here is an effective blend where we pair the strengths of each to produce a better whole. So that's the entire point of the next step in this journey. Thanks to advancements in autonomy, machine learning, computer processing power, and the ability to connect and share information, we are now at the cusp of a new generation of unmanned combat aircraft that will be able to function in a far more dynamic fashion without direct human control for most of their mission functions. Will people step into the loop for particular functions like authorizing weapons launches? Perhaps, but this is more a question of double-checking the machine's decision-making to avoid things like friendly fire. The Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies has been at the forefront of this work for the last couple of years. We've authored papers on the subject, and we know the key people involved in the research and development. We've also provided our insights to folks in industry, the military, and Congress as to how the nation best captures the promise of manned and unmanned teaming. So without further delay, I'd like to bring in one of our key experts in this area and a regular on the podcast, Mark Gunzinger. As you recall, Gonzo flew the B-52, has served in senior positions throughout the government, including the National Security Council, and as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. His insights in this realm are especially helpful because not only does he understand what it means to fly combat missions, but he is also an expert when it comes to understanding this technology. So with that, Gonzo, thanks for being here today.
Great being here. Thank you.
First question for you, Gonzo. Since the early years of manned flight, drones have existed in various forms. What's different today that suggests that human pilots and machine pilots, so to speak, can soon actually team together?
Slick, that's a great question to start with. So we've all heard how various technologies are going to be game changers, but we're always about 5 years away from being fielded. Now, many of these technologies are now ready to transition to real capabilities on the ramp. And today, not in some distant future. I'll mention three that make man-on-man teaming a near-term reality. First, advances in processing power and miniaturization make it practical to design AI-enabled UAVs. These UAVs will have open software architectures that can be upgraded at their home stations, not maintenance depots. Second, we now have advanced data links that can maintain secure line-of-sight connectivity between aircraft, and that's critical to teaming operations in the contested airspace. And finally, AI has matured to the point that it's practical to field unmanned and manned systems that improve a pilot's ability to anticipate changes in the battle space, increase their awareness and reach, and improve their productivity. But I'd like to mention one more human point. Pilots who flew jets with, say, early train following systems didn't use them because they either didn't trust them or they kept their hands on their flight controls in case the machine made a mistake. But operators now trust their machines to accomplish even more complex functions. So the predictability and reliability of today's UAVs have created a degree of trust that passes the threshold for a real manned-unmanned teaming.
Well, I appreciate all those comments, Gonzo. And I have to just zoom out here for a second and ask you, what is the driver behind why the Air Force is going in this direction?
Well, certainly the time needed to conduct operations in a way that requires multiple human-to-human interfaces, it's a major disadvantage in an informationized world. So our military is integrating AI, machine learning, and other technologies to create decision cycles that will give them a decisive information advantage. Also, humans simply cannot keep pace with the vast amount of data that streams in the cockpits from multiple sources. They have to rely on machines with the right algorithms to rapidly fuse that data and then present the pilots with the information they need when they need it. And finally, the Air Force now lacks the capacity to fight even a single war with a peer adversary, which is why it must grow modestly by 2030. Fielding new UAVs that are capable of teaming operations can help fill the Air Force's capacity shortfalls. Can help address everything I just mentioned. They're going to be force multipliers that extend the sensor and weapons range of manned aircraft, can detect threats, and allow pilots to avoid or engage threats before an enemy can react.
Yeah, and one thing I definitely understand is the United States Air Force needs more combat capacity. And as any listener to this podcast knows, we've said it a few times, that we are flying, we being the United States Air Force, flying the oldest, smallest combat inventory in its history. And that part has to change. Now, what's different about this next generation of unmanned aircraft?
You're right, Slick. That has to change. And I'll tell you, the next generation unmanned aircraft will be able to perform nearly every mission that manned aircraft can perform today, including counter-air sorties, precision strikes, even aerial refueling. They'll also enable manned aircraft to operate in new, non-traditional ways. Think of F-35s as air battle managers that can control 6, 7, or 8 UAVs each. I'd also like to mention the advent of what's called skyborne UAVs, or maybe better said, low-cost, attritable UAVs, such as the developmental Valkyrie. These are called attritable because they cost somewhere between $2 million and $20 million each, depending on the mission systems. And they won't need a lot of sustainment funding since they are designed to fly between 10 and 100 sorties. So not only will these attritable UAVs help increase the Air Force's combat capacity as its budget flattens, they're going to open the aperture for new operating concepts. An F-35 pilot or a B-21 crew could use teamed attritable UAVs, for example, as decoys, or direct those UAVs to emit and cause a threat to react and reveal its location. That would improve the survivability of our penetrating aircraft and their crews. And these attritable UAVs will also be modular and capable of changing their mission systems or otherwise adapting to meet operational needs, possibly even between sorties.
All right, Gonzo. So now I'm going to say that I've drank the Kool-Aid and I'm convinced. So my next question for you is, if this next generation of unmanned aircraft is so capable, why not go all in on them and skip buying the high-end planes like manned B-21s and F-35s?
Another excellent question, Slick. Attritable UAVs, they're another option to increase the Air Force's combat capacity, but they're not a means to build a future force on the cheap. attritable UAVs will be force multipliers, but, you know, the very low observability, advanced sensors, automated information processing, and fusion capabilities of fifth-gen aircraft are also force multipliers. Furthermore, UAVs that have the exact same capabilities as fifth-gen aircraft will not be low cost. For example, building a UAV with a bomber-sized weapons payload and the stealth needed to penetrate advanced IADs will cost about as much as a stealth bomber. However, it would not have human pilots with years of operational experience capable of addressing unforeseen problems and completing kill chains in comms degraded or denied areas. The fact is, next generation unmanned and manned aircraft are both needed, and the real capability leap ahead will come from developing new operating concepts that best combine the attributes they both bring to the fight.
All right, Gonza, that absolutely makes sense, and I totally understand where you're going with all this. Now, in your paper, I also see that you emphasize that these unmanned types won't always need a traditional airbase access. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, some attritable UAVs, such as the Valkyrie, can be containerized and deployed to undeveloped locations, set up and launched with or without a runway, and then be recovered by a parachute or another means before they're regenerated for the next mission. So that independence from air bases would improve the Air Force's ability to conduct distributed operations and generate combat power from inside an enemy's A2AD threat envelope. It will also complicate an enemy's ability to find, fix, track, and attack our air forces compared to today, where the Air Force still relies on a relative handful of main operating bases to generate sorties.
Yeah, well, you've laid that out really, really clearly, and awesome technology that is definitely coming our way. Well, what else were you missing here, Gonzo? Any further points you want to make?
Slick, I think you've covered the basics. I'd like to end with one thought. It's time for the Air Force to get on with operationalizing advanced technologies it needs to keep pace with China. However, it must not delay fielding new capabilities today in the hope that something better is just a few years in the future. That's what they've done in the past, and that's why we have the smallest and oldest Air Force on the ramp today. So the Air Force should start buying next-generation high-end platforms, next-generation UAVs, get them into the hands of America's airmen, and let them figure out new ways to use them.
Well, Gonzo, as always, thank you so much for your insights. It was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Pleasure, Slick. Thank you.
Joining me next is Colonel Don Stryker Haley, who is one of the main intellectual leaders behind this concept at Headquarters Air Force. Stryker is an F-15E Strike Eagle pilot by trade. He has commanded at the squadron level, including taking his unit to war during Operation Inherent Resolve over Syria, and now currently works in Air Force Futures. So, Stryker, we've been exploring the manned-unmanned teaming concept with Gonzo, and he's provided us with some great insights. But I'd also like to hear from you as one of the key guys working this in the Pentagon. So, to kick this off, is there a choice whether or not we go down this path?
Okay, thanks so much for that question. So, I think for those of us who follow closely messaging coming from the Air Force, we've heard Chief Brown's paper that talks about the need to accelerate change or lose. So we know that our current force is on the wrong path. And when we look at things like autonomy, we see just commercially the effect that that's having on our economy and the effect that with our daily lives. Certainly we've seen technologies like small UAS or connectivity and software and how that has military value. And what we see with these platforms as we move into the future is a need for us to invest in just the capability to employ manned-unmanned teaming or to take to leverage autonomous technologies. And certainly we need to broadly invest in those kind of capabilities for our future airmen.
Well, Stryker, you spent a lot of your career flying combat missions. The Strike Eagle has been a key asset over Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Talk us through how you would fly a mission today in your Strike Eagle, and then contrast that with what a manned-unmanned teaming mission might look like.
Yeah, great question there. So I would think what we would contrast what our last two decades of wartime experience has been, primarily low-intensity conflict. And certainly the Strike Eagle has excelled in that realm with long loiter times, ability to have two people in the aircraft to enter in what's actually some complex situations on the ground. But as we look to the future, as we look towards fulfilling the national defense strategy, we see, you know, the competition with China and Russia, and that is a much different way of fighting. So if I were to take my fourth generation platform in the Strike Eagle, which is a highly capable platform, it becomes more and more at risk, certainly in the air domain in the future. The value I think you see with a man-machine teaming with autonomous collaborative platforms is the ability to take a machine that's perhaps relatively stealthy, relatively survivable, and put it into the highly contested environment, performing sensing missions, things that would extend our ability to understand the battle space. And certainly if you pair that with a fourth gen capability that perhaps has longer range munitions, that enhances that platform survivability. When you team a future combat system that is autonomous, certainly I can take risk with it because it's unmanned and it's performing some of those missions in that highly contested environment. It makes a fourth generation platform, I think, certainly more viable in the future. And then as you then team that with the larger, broader design of fifth and sixth gen platforms, then you get what we would call a hybrid capability.
Well, you mentioned a key word, survivability, and survivability is going to be a vital element in the future. Places like the Pacific or Europe are going to be far more dangerous than places we've flown over the past 20 years in the Middle East or Africa. So how will you keep these unmanned aircraft survivable yet affordable? And I'm assuming things like stealth are essential. And if we expect these aircraft to penetrate enemy air defenses, they're going to have that capability.
You're right. I think we see this as a family of capabilities. So we talk about, there's different terms out there. If you talk about autonomous collaborative platforms, certainly there's a utility for an autonomous platform to operate and say in a contested environment, not necessarily be designed to be as stealthy. Certainly if you're going to operate in a highly contested environment, there's going to have to be a degree of survivability, a degree of stealth that these kind of platforms would need to realize their full utility. And then you get into this cost question, and I think this is an important one. A lot of times we fail with labels. We've talked about this being low cost, attributable technologies, which that's important. But what I think we need to look at is not only the platform cost, but what does the platform bring for me? What's the value proposition? And sometimes we concentrate solely on that. We call it APUC, so the average per unit cost, and try to compare it to other systems. I think what you get out of these systems is a cost savings that is not always immediately apparent from the overall price tag. So for instance, in my manned aircraft, you know, I have to fly that as a pilot. I need to fly 8 or 9 times a month to maintain currency. With an autonomous platform, I could perhaps have a much lower utility rate and not fly it quite as much. Certainly the operating cost on these platforms, we've already done some analysis that has shown that it's quite a bit cheaper than our current manned platforms. So what we see is a savings in your average operating cost. And then as we look at different ways, Dr. Roper has talked about digital engineering, looking at shorter lifetime cycles on these kinds of aircraft. What we see is a less maintenance heavy kind of platform, less requirements to fly it, lower operating costs. So what you see is over the life cycle of the platform, a much smaller cost. And it depends on your assumptions. It depends on the platforms, but on the order of sometimes half or even more of our current manned platforms. When we start trying to missionize and make these systems more survivable, I think you're going to see a per unit cost a little bit higher than maybe some people aimed for initially. But I think the value comes in the overall life cycle and the overall value that these platforms will bring over their entirety of their use.
Okay, Stryker, let me be blunt. You and I both know there's a big difference between competency to take off, fly around, and land versus truly being combat competent. So for human pilots, this takes years of highly demanding training. Now, what key technology thresholds must be met before you would trust one of these unmanned aircraft on your wing? And when might these thresholds be met?
I think let's talk about first, what's the minimum requirement, you know, especially if you're going to talk about a concept of manned unmanned teaming. So as a flight lead with a, let's call it a wingman, typically my wingmen are they're younger, they're more inexperienced than your flight leads. And I generally have very low requirements and our expectations as a flight lead for my formation to be successful. I would tell a young wingman something simple as, don't hit me, don't hit the ground or anything attached to it. Stay in formation, hit your target, and safely land back home. So as a men requirement, if I had a system that could perform as a young wingman, those are some very basic tasks. What I think the kind of technologies that we're going to need to implement to make something like this a reality is going to be much more of a software focused force. What I would imagine is a world where I go and fly with an autonomous platform, and I'm probably, that system is probably going to perform some things very well. There's going to be perhaps new tactics or something I learned on that mission that I'm going to need some kind of a software patch or a way to get that platform to behave differently in the future. So I'm going to need a very quick way to debrief, to get that in the hands of a software engineer to make those changes in the platform behavior to then implement those changes and then put them back out in the field. That process that we have right now takes often years to change softwares in our platforms that we have. So when I get to the point where I would like to perhaps change or make small updates on a much more regular basis, that's going to be a very different paradigm. So I think when we get to that paradigm, when we start implementing a way of being a more software-centric force, I think we're going to see these kind of capabilities go from doing something very basic to perhaps being able to very quickly grow to more and more advanced and adaptable tactics.
Can you trust, or more to the point, how do you trust an unmanned future aircraft to carry and deliver missions? And this can be tricky given the dynamic nature of battle, space, deception measures, and other ethical issues regarding the autonomy of a kinetic force.
So I think trust is going to be inherent in my ability to interact with these platforms early and often. So we've said that if we're going to bring this kind of technology to bear, that we need to get it in the hands of a warfighter and experiment early and often. I would certainly think that at least in the beginning, that it wouldn't be as different from the way we operate with certain features of autonomy today. I'll give you an example. So when I go out and I fly my Strike Eagle in an air-to-air mission, I have a onboard computer that is interpreting what my radar is seeing. I have multiple sensors, and this computer is fusing some of these different signals out there and helping me to achieve some level of combat identification. So there's already some autonomy inherent in these systems in being able to process signals and to present information to the pilots. Then the next thing is, say, if I were going to shoot an air-to-air missile, an AMRAAM, the way that that missile works, it's semi-active. So when I shoot it, initially I'm tracking, I've identified it, I'm relying on a computer to do that. And then at some point, the missile becomes autonomous during its flight. And I actually cease communicating, my aircraft ceases communicating with the missile, and it terminates, it completes the engagement with autonomy. And it has certain software filters in there in case it loses track or if it sees multiple aircraft when it gets closer, and it will behave a certain way. And I know what those behavior characteristics are. But certainly the rules of engagement and whether or not we're using lethal force, all of that is a human decision. And that is made before takeoff even occurs. I see a lot of parallels in these platforms where there's going to be rules of engagement. There's going to be certain combat ID criteria according to how restrictive the rules of engagement are. And the system is going to have certain autonomous behaviors and certain behaviors that rely on commands from a human. It's not unlike what we do today. It just those autonomous behaviors may begin at a greater range from the target than they currently do now. So if you think of it that way, it's just an extension where perhaps I'm just drawing a line or making certain decisions where certain autonomous behaviors occur. But, you know, war is inherently fought in a cognitive and a human domain. So there's always going to be a human element in it.
Now, finally, how do you see the role of combat airmen changing? I'd imagine we see levels of autonomy entering manned cockpits as well. And that will change how pilots function.
What machines do well is if I have a closed problem set, you know, a complicated problem, machines work complicated problems very, very well. Humans work complex problems. So unbounded, unended, you know, the things are constantly changing. So what I see is the autonomy in the cockpit, it's grown. So when I first started flying the T-38A model, it doesn't have an autopilot. And so just flying that airplane takes a tremendous amount of concentration just to maintain altitude. A half degree of pitch change could lead to hundreds of feet of altitude change. So it takes an enormous amount of my energy just to focus, just to maintain altitude. When I started flying the Strike Eagle, it's actually a much easier airplane to fly. It has an autopilot on it, and I use the autopilot a lot. So I would turn the autopilot on to maintain altitude. And when I do that, it allows me to think more broadly, to look at what's happening tactically, to understand my environment, to make decisions about tactics and flow, to watch my wingmen and monitor what they're doing. And the more and more we build more and more autonomy into our fifth-gen platforms, where we have better sensors, better sensor fusion, better ways to present information, we make the aircraft more and more simple to operate, the more and more cognitive functions that are available for the pilots to do other things. So what I imagine in the future is that I have more of these autonomous platforms that are doing tasks that take me a long time. You know, in the Strike Eagle, I have to do a lot of sensor fusion and looking at all the different sensors I have and trying to make decisions based on those sensors. When I have platforms that are doing a lot of those difficult tasks, it frees my ability to think more broadly about the situation and handle the complexities and more a lot better. So really, I become more of an operator of several machines, but I'm able to handle complexity much better because less of my energy is devoted to doing the complicated tasks that machines are accomplishing for me.
Well, Stryker, thanks so much for your time today. Your answers were absolutely phenomenal, and we just appreciate, as always, hearing from you.
Slick, always enjoy working with Mitchell, and I really appreciate what you guys do helping the broader community understand some of these technologies and where we're going with them. We're all trying to learn together, and it's been a real joy being here with you today.
From both of our conversations today, I can summarize some important themes. First, this era is coming. It's not a choice. The current and future threat demands a different set of options, and we must seek out new ways of doing business. Second, folks have really put in a lot of thought into the subject. It's not some lightning bolt from the blue idea. We've been on this track for a long time, and it's a good thing. Third, this is not simply a bolt-on capability. Maximizing this new option will demand evolving what it means to fly and fight from the man side as well. This demands a holistic assessment of what needs to change. So considering all of that, I'd like to bring a third perspective onto the show, the folks actually building this technology. Joining us today are Mike Atwood, Senior Director for Advanced Programs at General Atomics, and Steve Fendley, President for Unmanned Systems Division at Kratos Defense and Security Solutions. Many of you will recognize General Atomics as the UAV leader who brought us Predator and Reaper. And for those of you tracking the aviation press, Kratos' Valkyrie is certainly a high-profile player in the new manned-unmanned teaming world. Both are working on the Air Force's Skyborg program, which is one of the key technology demonstration efforts in this vein, and it is set to see real aircraft hit the flight line later this year. This question is for both of you. How do you see this differing from a traditional aircraft development program? Air Force acquisition leaders like Dr. Roper have been pushing for a new way of doing business. Have you seen this manifest in this program?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, we knew Dr. Roper very well at the SCO, and I think that's where he started getting his ideologies from MIT kind of more formed. We were really excited to see the formation of the Vanguard programs and kind of realize his vision. The challenge that we've had is that though we have the digital engineering tools, there's still amount of bureaucracy in the DoD at the execution level. So though we might bring systems engineering and digital thread to bear, it's hard for the DoD machine to take the amount of empowerment at the execution level. But I think Roper did move the needle. I think we are moving in the right direction. We've started making e-models of our aircraft that allow the government to stress those. People like Colonel Haley have been using those at AFWICS to do the requirements down select. But we really haven't seen the acceleration in building aircraft and getting them to the flight line. And I think that will be the next 5 years, is how do we take the initial requirements development and system optimization and take that to manufacturing? I think there's some very exciting programs in the Department of Defense. They're going to lead that. I think Skyborg will hang on the coattails of those programs. But at the core of what we're seeing and what Roper was pushing was the idea of risk acceptance and empowerment at the lowest level decision makers. And I think that's going to take a little bit more time than Roper had hoped, but we're very eager to see that happen. And we're very excited to bring the Skyborg capability to the flight line.
All right, Steve, over to you.
So number one, the basic aircraft isn't predefined. The basic aircraft requirements aren't really predefined. With the exception of, it starts with a flying unmanned aircraft baseline. So for this program, you show up with a flying airplane. The government hasn't said exactly what that system needs to be. So I think that's very unique here. And I think it echoes what Dr. Roper's approach is, which is let's take some technologies that are developed and mature at different levels, and let's convert them, integrate them, evolve them into an application system that can solve today's problems. Another thing that I think is a little bit different than a traditional program here is the integration of multiple segments. And again, this comes from the perspective of some fairly mature elements in some cases, and then some very new elements and segments in other cases. Obviously, the basic UAS has to be reasonably mature, at least from a design perspective, because that's a starting point on the program. The AI autonomy architecture, there's some foundation for that, and there are lots of different technologies associated there. But that architecture itself is part of what's being developed by the SDA, and technically that'll be pretty new here for the Skyborg application. Very interesting. Comm systems, they'll be integrated. Obviously, you need to have open interfaces to support those, and they need to work cooperatively with the existing manned systems. And then ultimately, the mission systems and payload. So it's integrating these various elements which have different technology and production readiness levels. And then finally, the multiple contractors and multiple platform solutions. That's a little different than many programs, because usually the platform basis is much, much, much closer than what I think we see on Skyborg. And that's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, gentlemen, I'm going to ask a simple question, but it's really important for our audience to understand. How do you know when you're succeeding? A program like this is built upon so many small steps yielding successful major muscle movements. So let's talk about this from an inside vantage. Steve?
Yeah, so I love your analogy there. Totally agree with it. The small steps for major muscle movements. And to me, ultimately, it's about advancing the comprehensive capability. It really is a capability focus, again, tying back to Dr. Roper's objectives. It'd be really easy to focus on just technology advancement, and there are a lot of technologies that will be advanced in this program. But the key is, have you integrated those technologies, and have you improved the capability along with doing it? How can you apply the unmanned technology to advance the defensive capability, but at the same time, reduce the risk to the human, and then, of course, with affordability as being a recurring checkpoint? You know, I would say on the program, the various tests, and these are ground tests and flight tests, they'll each include a number of specific test points, and they'll be focused on various subsystem capabilities. Every test won't be 100% successful. You've heard Dr. Roper talk about, if you're 100% successful, you're not challenging yourself enough. I think over the course of the program, we will naturally evolve toward an optimization of certain configurations and approaches that apply to specific mission objectives, teaming arrangements, and operating methods.
I think we have to take a series of small steps and succeed or fail at those small steps. You know, Roper always said, you know, fail early and often. You learn so much more than your small failures that propel you forward. So I think it's a focus on integration to move forward. It's a focus on testing, taking what we already have and showing what the AI can do. But the way that I know it's succeeding you know, in my career with General Atomics, is seeing the combatant commanders and the warfighters embrace the system. A lot of times that'll come as cultural change. You know, you see a air combat command move the needle from fighters to unmanned aircraft. But we've seen a lot of the conflicts around the world, especially in counterinsurgency, allow this combat environment to really test how well that innovative solution is. So I think an early transition to the operational theaters is really the bar that I'm going to look to see if Skyborg is ultimately succeeding. I don't think it's outside the art of possible to see a PACOM, a Pacific Command deployment of Skyborg by 2025. That's, you know, generally called a QRC, a quick reaction capability, or a joint emerging operational need. And I'm hopeful to see the Vanguard transition out of the R&D phase and into that operational phase. I applaud what Skyborg's doing right now with what they call Delivery Order 2, which is to take the Kratos products and GA products and go experiment with them at large force exercises. So it's kind of a stateside combat evaluation of it. And we can take the planes that we already have, test the brains, test these autonomy cores, and see how close we really are to the success we need, you know, to operate in the PACOM theater and do the broad area sensing and off-board sensing for the manned fighters.
Well, it's a great segue to my next question of asking, how do your design teams differ from what we've seen in the past? Because no longer is this just about a good set of aerodynamic and structural engineering teams. Not only do you have to develop a top performing airframe, but you have to also excel with software development, system integration, AI, machine learning, et cetera. That has to demand such a broad range of talent.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see the new generation of engineers. They seem to be more based in a software systems engineering ideology. Software has really become the horsepower that drives our technology improvements. And with software engineering, you get systems engineering. So thinking about things not as a single airplane with an engine, but a system of systems with assets on the ground, in space. And so they tend to decompose the functions much more effectively. So once you take a broader system construct, it becomes an optimization problem. And so what we've seen recently is a huge investment in multidisciplinary optimization. And what that's allowed us to do is actively trade parameters and do sensitivity analysis. So the role of the systems engineer has become a lot more powerful. When we look at digital thread engineering, computer-aided design, computational fluid dynamics, a systems engineer can mold the ball of clay at the systems engineering level, and those lower level airframing functions, propulsion functions, electrical engineering functions are somewhat automated in the design process. This then ties us back to the digital thread that Roper has talked about to make more heterogeneous aircraft. So one production line can result in different types of aircraft. And I heard General Raymond say this too in your last episode 8. He was talking about space and the vulnerabilities of space. And there isn't a one-trick pony that we're going to need. We're going to need offense. We're going to need defense. We're going to need command and control. We're going to need mission planning. And the optimization of all those within space, the optimization of all those within the aircraft, and decomposing all that is driving this next generation of engineers to think as system constructs and not just as airplanes.
Yeah, you're going to hear a lot of similarity here. I would say number one is integration, integration, integration. The role of the systems engineers and managing truly and fully integrated system of systems designs is the critical element here. Very well thought out system architectures and well-defined interfaces are the key. Without that, your system will not work and you'll be in an endless do loop trying to make it work. You know, having engineers across the discipline spectrum who are experts in their field, which is critical, but they have to have a true understanding and a true respect for the ultimate system. Again, if they don't, what will happen is they'll build something, design something in their silo, and it ultimately won't work with the rest of the system or with the intent of the rest of the system. Moving to the next facet is digital engineering. So it's both the buzz phrase and it's reality. Digital engineering in general has been around for many, many, many years. There really is more to it today because instead of just a digital model and tool stovepipes, now we have even more comprehensive integration that's at the digital engineering level. So it's not use digital engineering to solve specific problems and then put them all together. It's actually integrate even at that model level. It's extremely powerful. And it can be a substantial time and cost saver when it's implemented properly and at the right mix. And this is something that's a real hot button of mine, which is my opinion is that digital engineering alone can give you a false sense of security if you rely too heavily on it and haven't implemented it in a systems type manner. And it's the mix of digital engineering, subsystem prototyping, and subset testing that I believe is the real key to success. And then obviously with a heavy focus on the risk areas and performing testing and actual prototyping in those areas.
What is your take on what's happening abroad? What are our friends and allies doing in this realm? And also, what about our adversaries?
I would say that our major allies have similar programs and systems underway or in development. A great example is the UK Lanka Mosquito Program, focused on development of a high-capability missionized UAS intended for manned-unmanned teaming and other missions. And again, that's really tracks well with some things that are going on in the U.S. I would say from the near-peer adversary perspective, I think they tend to copy and replicate the U.S. systems, and they've been doing this for years in unmanned systems and in the manned systems. I think it's interesting. We watch our other adversaries show up with really lower capability systems, but the thing that's a constant is there's a definite focus by all of them on UAS in general.
Mike?
Yeah, I think the ally story is very, very interesting to me. I think the Australians and what they've done with the F-35 and the F-18 is a good litmus of where Skyborg is headed. So if you don't know the backstory there, the Australians have about 24 Super Hornets, and they tried to buy over 100 F-35s, and they really couldn't find the national treasure to buy the F-35s that they wanted. So they started with a very low buy in the 20s, I think. I think they might be pushing that up into the 70s, but they needed to find a way to do more with less. And so, you know, they went out and they decided to build a loyal wingman to augment their F-18s and their F-35s. And you see that in the Boeing air teaming solution. And I think it shows you the value proposition of kind of bald eagles turning into bumblebees. This idea that we have these F-22 Raptor type fighters that can do everything and anything, but they're just so dang expensive. And when the allies don't have the kind of resources that the American DoD has, they bring a heterogeneity to the mix. They bring more force mass to the mix. In the middle of them picking to go with the loyal wingmen for the F-18 to lower the F-35 by, they realize the value that loyal wingmans have to their wedge tails, their airborne early warning systems. And so I think they have it right. And in some ways, I think they have it a little bit more culturally correct than the US forces today. I think you see the UK then jumping in with that, you know, with Lanka and what they're doing there. You know, both the Australians and the UK both have experience with the MQ-9 Reaper. So they've tasted what it's like to operate these unmanned aircraft. And I think they've seen the power of the combat mass that you can bring. When we switch the table over to our adversaries, they're actually at a disadvantage right now. They're used to stealing all our secrets with their cyber effects, but they can't do that here because they're right at the state of art right now. So they can't copy what we haven't made yet. And so what we see them doing in their defense industries is trying to figure out how to do all the things we're talking about on the call and stumbling a little bit.
Gentlemen, if you could look 10 to 15 years into the future, describe how you see the Air Force projecting combat air power. How will your technologies play in the bigger picture?
It's hard to go that far in the future and understand, but I see a world where there's a unified common operating picture, not just amongst the Air Force, but amongst the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And I think of it like a chess game. We have a really hard time seeing the red pieces, but we have an even harder time seeing the blue pieces because in an inner service, we don't work together. And I see that chessboard being fully populated with all the chess pieces, both blue and red. And then I see a IBM Watson in the back end running all permutations of all outcomes at all the time and advising humans on risk acceptance and decision-making. I see that being done across multiple domains, subsurface, surface, air, and space. I see laser data links using high bandwidth pipes to give AI engines, you know, predictive algorithms on imagery and RF analyzation. And I see our fighter pilot communities and our wide bodies taking more of a battle management role and less of a tactical role. The US has spent so much money putting our best and brightest in harm's way. And I think what we're gonna see is we're gonna bring those people back stateside, bring them back on the outside layer of the threat regions, and we're gonna project in with these unmanned systems.
Mike, thanks for that. Steve?
Sure. So it's very clear to me that there'll be an increasing use and leverage of unmanned aircraft to support the USAF projection of combat power. I think no one would argue that. I see it from the range of mission capabilities in the direct areas of manned-unmanned teaming for offboard weapons, offboard sensors, onto the indirect combat power areas like supporting data relays and intelligence collection. The point there is they're always going to be working together. They're always integrated in a manner to protect the human and to increase the power and effectiveness of the exquisite assets. I think the three constant truths here are that the application of UAS to increase the survivability of our exquisite assets, to increase the survivability of our personnel, and to reduce our DoD costs will remain. I think those are all truisms, and I think we'll see that basically multiply in each of those areas as time goes forward. I don't think we're going to replace the exquisite assets in total. I think we continue to need those. We will need those forever. They're critical. I think what we will do, though, is we'll apply these evolving unmanned technologies in a way that increases the value and the effectiveness of those exquisite assets.
Well, Steve and Mike, I can't thank you enough for both of you being here today.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure to be here and look forward to the future of unmanned aircraft.
Same pleasure, John. Enjoyed it.
In many ways, I feel like we are seeing the dawn of a new age. So much like how air power technologists pushed the envelope coming out of World War II and space leaders excelled in the 1950s, today is a similar moment. Today's industry leaders are charting the next juncture in aerospace power technology that will yield huge benefits to our nation's defense. The threats we are facing today are growing. We need to accelerate the teaming of humans and machines to keep our Air Force in the lead position. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for today's discussion and to you, our listeners. If you like what you heard today, please go ahead and hit that like button, follow and subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage podcast to stay up to date on the latest episodes. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or by following us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, fly safe and check six.